This is Radio Boston. I'm Walter Wuthman in Studio 2. And Tiziana Dearing is at our Statehouse Bureau today, where she's sitting down with Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey. Healey has big plans, from a multi-billion dollar housing bond bill to an economic development package that would make the state a hub for climate tech and applied artificial intelligence. So how are those plans faring against this economy, our legislature, and global political realities? Let's get the lay of the land from Tiziana Dearing. Tiziana, welcome.
Hi there, Walt.
Sort of a role reversal here.
Yep, so we're trying something new. The governor is sitting across from me right now. We're in this little room in the State House. Usually we have to talk sort of sight unseen, so we thought, let's meet around a circle table and see if we can do this face to face.
Are you all settled in? Are you ready to go?
We are ready to go. Do you want me to take it from here, Walt?
Let's go. Over to you with our conversation with Governor Maura Healey.
Thanks, Walt. Governor, thanks for joining me here in the state, or me joining you, however you
want to say it. Good morning, and welcome to the State House.
Thank you. It's great to be here. So I want to start. Do you know that meme, how it started, how it's going?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're in your second year now. If you had to do the meme, what would be your how it started and what would be your how it's going?
Oh, I'm going to leave that to others. Your listeners will have fun. Submit your ideas, I guess, right, to Radio Boston. How do I characterize it? Look, it's been a great year. I mean, we've gotten a lot done in the first year. We cut taxes for the first time in 20 years. People are going to see the benefit of that when they file their income taxes this spring. In particular, make sure if you're a senior, take advantage of our doubling of the senior circuit breaker. If you have dependents or children at home, know that you will now benefit from the most generous child and dependent tax credit in the country. So those are just some things. Free school breakfast and lunch for young people. Mass Reconnect, a program where now you're 25 and older, you can attend any community college for free. Already we've seen 45% increase in enrollment. Those are just a few of the things that we were able to do this year. Obviously, we've got our challenges, and I've tried to be really clear with the public about those challenges and how we plan to address them. First among those, housing. We've also recently filed a really exciting economic development bill that's going to allow us to lean into certain sectors, life science, climate tech, applied AI, along with supporting and growing our creative economy and tourism. I say that, you're in the State House. This is a building that goes back to 1780. Paul Revere and Sam Adams laid the original cornerstone of this foundation. And next year, we celebrate the 250th anniversary of where it all began, right here in Boston and in Massachusetts. So lots of exciting stuff coming up. And I continue to be grateful for the opportunity to work alongside Kim Driscoll and our team and try to make things better for folks in the state.
So in a minute, I want to get to the economic development and the housing. I will ask, so it's a marathon, not a sprint, but you sort of have hash marks along the way. You just laid out several things you wanted to get done in the first year that you got done. Was there anything, every leader has one thing that they wanted to get done in the first round that doesn't happen, and they're like, so I'm going to get it done in the second round. What was your thing that didn't happen in round one in that first year that you wish had, and now you really want to get it done now?
You know, there's probably things that I would have wanted to see more progress on. Housing. It's why we continue to talk about that as our top priority, and it's why we filed the housing bond bill, the big bill, $4 billion housing bond bill, basically to allow us go out and borrow to incent the kind of housing production that we need. But, you know, when we prepared for the state of the state, we went through the list of everything I promised when I was sworn in over a year ago, and I was really delighted that we hit the mark on everything. We couldn't identify something that we didn't say we were going to do that we didn't do. Obviously, there's so much more to do, and I'm excited about the work that's ahead and the opportunity that's ahead.
So housing bond bill, over $4 billion, focus on number of units, affordability. One of the things that stands out to me is accessory dwelling units as a right in cities and towns. What's running in the back of my mind is the pushback on the MBTA Communities Act, which now the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts will hear the Attorney General's case on that. The pushback on that has been strong. Does it signal other challenges that you may face in cities and towns to components of that housing bond bill, such as allowing accessory dwelling units by right, or other components that you're keeping an eye on, since this is a really big part of your platform?
Yeah. I'll just frame it a little bit. You know, Massachusetts, Tiziana, we're the number one state for women. We were just voted the number one state to live in if you are a woman. We're the number one state in per capita venture funding, which is important to fueling some of the industries and sectors that I just mentioned. There's so much good here. There's so much great things, so many great things about our state and what's happening. But the reason right now young people are leaving Massachusetts or may decide to leave Massachusetts, the reason seniors may opt to move somewhere else, the reason employers may decide to locate somewhere or not expand here, is because of the cost of housing. It is holding us back and holding all of us back. Now, the good news is we've put forward some policies and some ideas that can change that, that can deal with the fact that as a result of underinvestment in housing, we're down a couple hundred thousand housing units statewide from what we actually need. Anybody who's looked for an apartment or looked to buy a house will tell you it is impossible to get in the door. We have the lowest vacancy rate or among the lowest vacancy rates in the country. So in terms of pushback, we may see some here or there. I'll just remind people, the MBTA Communities Act, that was passed before I became governor. It was signed into law, passed nearly unanimously, signed into law by Governor Baker. Nearly all of the communities have complied with the law to date. And remember, it's a law that simply requires the rezoning of areas. It doesn't actually require the development or the production of housing. It just requires a reframing and a rezoning of areas. So I hope that we can work through the issues with Milton and, you know, get that squared away. But the housing bond bill, what's exciting about the bond bill, Tiziana, is we offered up a number of ways we can get there. Accessory dwelling units in places they're referred to as granny flats. This is the idea that you can basically take your garage or add on to an existing structure, a unit that doesn't have to be, it isn't super large, but it's certainly
900 square
feet. Exactly. And we've seen around the country that this is the fastest way to increase the number of housing units, like almost overnight, you can increase the number of housing units.
So I hear you on this. I think the question is, and it is striking, by the way, that your administration is the one getting the pushback on a law that a different administration passed with strong legislative support.
And I want to be clear, I strongly support the law as well. And it's just one of the ways we need to get there. The other way is through this bond bill, giving developers the support, giving them the incentives that they need in order to produce housing.
I think
public
the question,
housing, affordable housing, market rate, and workforce housing.
I think part of the structural question, Governor, is Massachusetts, are our cities and towns, when it comes to housing, we have been so used to so much local control. Can cities and towns maintain the level of local control to which they have become accustomed, and we solve the problem you just laid out?
Yes, provided we all do the job of educating one another and working with communities on the imperative for us to build housing. See, the fact is, not any single city or town can solve the housing crisis in the state. It's going to require collective action, everybody working together. For each community, it's different. It's no one size fits all, and different communities can look to do different things. But we've all got to get on board and all got to get on the same page about housing and our need to do everything that we can to grow the availability of housing, to make housing more affordable. I don't like it when I read that 1 in 5 young people between the ages of 18 and 30 are going to leave Boston.
Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce survey that recently came out.
And I can tell you, spending time with employers, spending time with industry, I spoke, speaking of the Greater Boston, I spoke a couple weeks ago at the Chamber event. And after the event, I talked about our economic development bill and what we'd filed, and also housing and the bond bill. Afterwards, I was approached by women who run a search firm for our life sciences companies. And we're the global epicenter, remember, of life sciences here, and we want to grow that. They told me, Governor, I am so glad you mentioned housing, because as we try to recruit people into our life science companies. We have the jobs. The reason we're not able to is they can't afford to live. And these are people making well over six figures, right? So it's just indicative of the scope and the scale of this problem and why we need everybody to come together. As I say, we're not looking to take away local control at all, but we are looking for everybody to realize that if we don't meet this moment and work together, and every community can do it in different ways, there's flexibility out there, we're going to see people leave the state, and we're going to suffer for that. Massachusetts, it's a great, great place to live, to raise a family, to grow a business, if you can afford to live here.
I'm Tiziana Deering, and here in the State House with Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey. So when we think about sequencing then, sort of chicken and egg, you've got more than $4 billion in the housing bill that you'd like to see passed. You've got a plan that's about $3.5 billion in economic development. It's got a talent piece. It's got a fundamentals piece, infrastructure, that kind of thing. It's got an industry piece, climate tech, life sciences. Am I understanding you then that, listen, at the end of the day, we don't solve the housing thing? The rest just doesn't have the juice it needs to take this state where we need to go.
Well, we're going to continue to deal with workforce challenges if we can't recruit and retain talent. You know, every year we have over 200,000 young people come to study at our great colleges and universities, and graduate students who then go on to build programs and even, you know, become young entrepreneurs with startups and looking to build companies. The reality is, though, they will look to go other places in the country where it is more affordable, and that would be a terrible loss for our state. So we've got to find a way to build housing. It is sad to me that seniors right now can't afford to downsize, sell their house, maybe pass a little on to younger generations, stay in Massachusetts so that they can be near grandkids. They can't afford to downsize because they can't afford to buy that next house.
Can this change fast enough for those? So 25% age 20 to 30 in the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce survey, and then we'll move on to some other subjects. But there's such an urgency there, right? I have a 22-year-old and a 19-year-old who are going to make life decisions in the next few years, right? Can you move the needle fast enough on this issue?
There is no issue that I am moving with greater urgency and intention than this issue of housing. And hopefully we can work with the legislature, get something done, and get something done soon. We need shovels in the ground. We need construction starts. I think about all the young people out there and not so young people out there, people in their 50s and their 60s, also paying rent. I mean, renters, and it's not just a Greater Boston issue. You know, as I travel the state, this is an issue statewide, housing. Frankly, it's an issue across our country as I talk to other governors. I mean, lack of housing, lack of affordable housing. So we've got to address this. We've got to address it now. And I will continue to, and the LG will continue to do anything we can to get this over the goal line. Again, $4 billion, $3.5 billion on an economic development bill. I just want to remind listeners that we're not talking about spending, okay? This isn't budget, this isn't expenses, this isn't spending, this is borrowing. The benefit of us having a record high rainy day fund and an excellent rating, which we just got a bump up earlier this year, is that we have the capacity, the ability to go out and borrow. And to me, it is so important that we do this, and we do this now so that we can get moving on housing production. By the way, we want sustainable housing. Also, we're not necessarily talking always about new housing. Look at all the unused state property. Look at the old mills and factories and other structures, including office space, by the way. We just did an announcement recently on that we want to work to convert office space that is vacant or underutilized into housing. I was out in Worcester the other day at a site where that is going to happen. So a whole number of ways to get there. We can't go fast enough.
So that was $1 million for technical assistance for cities and towns that might want to take office space and turn it into residential space. So some of this can be really hard. And I'm gonna go back in time a little bit and bring something up. And I'm going to play a couple of pieces of sound for you. I know you are familiar with WBUR reporter Todd Wallach's look at vacancies in the state's public housing system. When he did his investigation back in September, he found more than 2,000 units were vacant. vacant, the state then launched a 90-day push to reduce that. Here's a little sound from Todd's follow-up reporting. This is Graciela Carter, who's a homeless mom who's couch surfing with her 5-year-old son. She was speaking to Todd about the need to reduce public housing vacancies. This is cut 3 for you in the studio.
Like, what can I say? You guys have the vacancies. I can't make anyone give me an apartment. All I can do is apply. But if no one offers me an apartment and you have just vacant units, like, it's clear that it's broken.
Todd's follow-up research found that only 72 units had been cleared, most of that after the state announced the push. And I asked him what happened to Graciela, and here in Cut 5, here he is explaining.
I mean, she often has to stay at a different place every night. For a while, she would sometimes have to leave her child with friends or family and then sleep in her car before her car got repossessed. She worries about how she's going to put her kid in school. He's supposed to start kindergarten in the fall. And it's really difficult when she's moving to different towns every day or every month.
He did talk to Housing Secretary Ed Augustus, who talked about the push. Why is this piece so hard?
We don't have enough housing. I mean, I'll speak to the public housing component.
But this is vacancies. These are pieces of housing that are there.
Well, let me just clarify that piece. You know, one of the things that we inherited when we came in was the fact that there were a number of public housing units that weren't being used because they weren't habitable. And we've worked hard to work through some of those issues. We've, in fact, seen for the first time in years under our administration a decrease in those public housing vacancies. We have more work to do. It's why I was pleased to get money from the Biden administration to help us rehabilitate those public housing units, also in green and sustainable ways, so that we can get people living in those units. But there's a broader issue here. You know, Graciela may have a voucher that allows her to go and find an apartment. The problem is, and we have a number of vouchers, the math doesn't work for people because the rents so exceed what's available in terms of the voucher limit. And this is the fundamental problem here. Rents are way too high. Housing prices are way too high. And it really is about the lack of affordable housing. We need more units. We need more housing. We need to drive down costs. And, you know, I don't want to see it. It breaks my heart. It breaks my heart to know that a mom, any person, but especially a mom with her children, has to couch surf the stress and the worry of finding a place to live. It's a stress and a worry we see when people have to decide whether they can pay the heating bill, buy groceries, or pay rent. I mean, that's the reality for too many people. And we've got an obligation in this state as a commonwealth. That's why it takes everybody, you know, the state, working with private development, working with communities to change this.
I'm going to shift gears for us a little bit, and I'm going to go light for just a minute. You did a podcast interview recently where you talked about the first live concert you'd ever been to, and I'm going to have the team back in Studio 2 play a little bit of music for us here. Can we fire up the Cool and the Gang back in the studio? You said that your first live show, I think, was Cool and the Gang.
I think that's right. Yeah.
So, when did you first discover Cool and the Gang?
You know, I'm born in 1971, so I think I was able to go with a friend and her big brothers and sisters to a show, Boston Common, sometime 1980, early 80s. Cool and the Gang. my taste evolved since then. And
I don't know. Cool and the Gang is good stuff.
I'm still Earth, Wind, and Fire,
yeah. too. You give me some Brick House, I'm still dancing.
Mm-hmm. September.
So, yep. There you go. So this was interesting in that. And listen, I'm glad we're face-to-face for this part of the conversation because I want to talk to you about this personal life, public life thing. And I want you to see in my eyes that I understand that this is complicated, right? People are entitled to their personal lives. And also, a governor has this unique role. And you are getting pushback for, Matt Stout reported it in the Boston Globe, not telling people first when you went on a vacation in February and then not afterwards saying where you went. Previously, you had said in November, listen, for security reasons, I'm not going to say where I'm going before I go, but that your calendar would offer the information afterward. This was different. Why the extra change? Listen, you don't even get to know where I was afterward. Governor, why?
Yeah. Well, I want to be clear about the state of play here. I produce my calendar. I always disclose my work travel, my travel associated with my duties and responsibilities as governor, and the details of those trips and who I'm meeting with and what I'm doing. I've done that. I'll continue to do that. The issue that a reporter raised was about my family travel, my family vacation. And I've just drawn a line and said that that information is for me and my family, and I'm going to protect my family privacy. There's nothing wrong with it. But whether or not I disclose, you know, that I'm going to this place on a Saturday or a Sunday with family, I'm going to continue to keep that information personal.
It's a departure from previous governors who have done it differently. What explain that, right? And your answer, it's not that it's an illegitimate answer to say that it's private, but it does merit explaining when other governors have done it differently, why you're drawing the line in a different place.
Well, I don't know that other governors have done it differently. And there have been times when I've disclosed where I've been on personal trips, as other governors have done. And also, it's not the case that that's the way it's always been done. So, look, I think the important thing for people to know is that I will always and will continue to disclose my work-related travel and all I do as governor, whether it's in the state or out of the state, and with respect to personal time and personal family time. And I'm going to continue to keep that personal.
Does this piece wear on you? This pushing on you about the personal stuff?
No. I mean, I guess it's of interest to maybe some, but you know, most people just want to know about what we're doing. You know, what are we doing on housing? What are we doing on the cost of living? What are we doing on economic growth? How are we protecting people's rights and freedoms? And you know, what are we doing to take care of kids? And you know, how are we working as governor and as a team to move this state ahead, to make us stronger. So that's, and there are stresses that come with that. Sure. I mean, it's a job that one takes and assumes, knowing that there's going to be a lot of stress and a lot of challenge. But again, I'm grateful to have the opportunity to serve and to work with a great team. And there's a lot of great, great people all across the state who want to see good, who want to see partnership. That's something that we've really tried to infuse in this administration. It's about teamwork. And I know it's corny because it's basketball season and March Madness. And yes, I was a former basketball player, but truly to get things done, our secret sauce is in our ability to work together. Private, public, government, academe, just community folks.
For one more question.
Sure.
I've read a number of academic articles and books in the last couple of years about our heightened climate of political violence. Are you less safe than previous governors, let's say over the last 30 years?
I don't know about me personally. I will say that the time that we are in, I don't think it's news to anybody. This is a time of heightened violence, vitriol, hate, demonstration. My friend, you know, Governor Whitmer in Michigan was the subject of a kidnapping attempt. We see all sorts of ugly things happening out there, not just directed at officials at the local, state, and federal level, but just more broadly too. We see this element, unfortunately, that has infused its way in, and so it's just something that, you know, we all have to account for.
Governor, one of the things that our education team was wondering about, and I'm sort of going to represent them in this next question for a minute, there is a ballot initiative to end the MCAS, and I wonder what you think of that.
You know, I've spoken to this before. I think that assessment is important. We need to be able to assess how our young people are doing. So I do not support getting rid of MCAS. I think there's a question about what do we do for young people, and there are about 700 each year who are unable to pass MCAS and therefore do not receive a high school diploma. We've got to find a way to take care of those young people, get them what they need, and see them through. So that's a different discussion that my team is engaged on right now. But I think that it's important to maintain the ability to assess our young people, and also, you know, to always express, you know, a willingness to consider what it is we're measuring, how we're measuring, right? What we may measure today may be different from a model we looked at years ago. Recently, for example, I launched a huge initiative around literacy, because I learned, it turned out that too many of our districts were using a non-evidence-based, scientifically proven curricula for reading. And that's hurting our young people. And so we've got to change that and make sure that we're getting the right resources, the right tools to students and also to educators, which is also why my initiative provides support and funding for educator development, professional development, so that we can get all the tools in place.
Time for one last question.
Oh, it's gone so quickly.
I know it does go fast. On Thursday, the state Senate will take up consideration of a similar proposal to the House on limiting time in the emergency shelter system. Are you in support of limits?
I am. I've spoken to this previously. I mean, you know, it is outrageous, the situation that we find ourselves in. It's unacceptable. It's certainly unsustainable. And it's happening here in New York, Illinois. You've seen in other places, the southern states, because Congress failed to act. Congress has failed to step in and fix a broken immigration system. It puts tremendous burden and strain on governors and on states. That I continue to call for that to happen. It was a shame that the House Republicans blew up that deal a few weeks ago. It would have solved so much of this. And in the meantime, you know, I've said that we are at capacity here in terms of our ability to house and safely care for the numbers that we're seeing.
Is 9 months the right number?
Well, we're going to talk more about that. I think that what's important also is that for people who have come here and they are here through the federal government, that they're here and we are getting them work authorizations. These people, if you've watched the news, you see what's going on in Haiti. They're fleeing desperate situations and they come here seeking to make a better life for their family. What they're most anxious to do is to work. And so I'm proud of my administration for working to process 3,000 people for work permits, people who right now are getting plugged in with employers who desperately need jobs filled, from our hospitals to academic institutions to any number of businesses. So we're going to continue to work that side of the problem while I continue to call for Congress, plead with Congress, please take action. You can solve this. You can fix the border. But it takes political will to do that. And right now, we haven't seen it.
Massachusetts Governor Murray Haley, thanks for letting me come to you this time here on Radio Boston. I know we'll talk to you again next month.
Great to be with you.
Thanks.
We'll do it again.
Thanks. Back over to you, Walt Wuthman, in Studio 2.
Thanks, Tiziana. That was Tiziana Dearing and Governor Maura Healey live at the State House. With us now for some analysis of Governor Healey's interview with Tiziana, we're joined by Matt Stout, politics reporter with the Boston Globe, Yawoo Miller, formerly senior editor of the Bay State Banner, and on the line is Chris Van Buskirk, State House reporter with the Boston Herald. Matt, Yawoo, and Chris, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having us.
Yawoo, I'll start with you. Just open question, reaction to what you just heard.
It sounds like for the governor, housing is a major linchpin that undergirds a lot of the challenges that she's facing. $4 billion housing bond bill seems like a bold move. There are a lot of challenges, and an issue like immigration, with the number of refugees who are here. On the one hand, it's putting a strain on resources. And on the other hand, without immigration in the last 20 years, Massachusetts would have lost population. So, workforce, or having people in the workforce, a sufficient number to keep businesses going is a huge challenge. And immigration plays a part in that. But without sorting out housing, it's just going to be an issue. It's the linchpin.
Yeah. Chris, you track the legislature really closely. Can you remind us the status of that $4 billion housing bond bill that the governor's proposing?
Yeah, it's still with the legislature. I believe a hearing occurred in the past couple months, and we'll just see if a deal comes out or if any more movement occurs and it crosses the finish line in both the House and the Senate before the legislative session ends this summer.
So, Matt, the governor responded to some of your reporting about her absences. You reported on this change of policy. Basically, she'd already changed policies to say that we would not get warning when she's going to leave the state, but that there would be information in these redacted calendars, which come out later. But you found out that there actually wasn't information about this 4-day family trip in February. You've been asking about that. She responded a bit earlier this week and then some more in this interview. And I was struck by, you know, her statement saying, I don't know if other governors have actually done this differently. I saw you raise your eyebrows and I wanted to just invite you to respond to that.
I mean, I've only been covering the legislature and the state house and the governor's office for about, like, you know, 10 or 11 years. So it's not as if I have this full breadth of knowledge. But, you know, covering the end of Deval Patrick and covering, you know, Charlie Baker, as far as I knew, we had regular at least notice of when they're traveling, you know, personally or officially, and generally, you know, just aware, you know, what state you're going to or what city you're going to. And I realize that there's a legitimate debate of that line of what do you disclose and do your, you know, the personal time, does that reflect on what you do professionally as a governor? You know, I think it's like case by case, but I mean, I guess as I think about this is, you know, right before the pandemic started in, well, not started, but until it really took hold and shut things down in March 2020, you know, Governor Baker made the choice to take a family trip to Utah, you know, the weekend, this would have been like, you know, March 9th, March 10th. A trip he had to cut short to come back and declare a state of emergency and really kind of start, you know, months of, you know, of a lockdown. And, you know, that's the decision he made, but at least we as the public had knew what choices he made. He made a choice to take a personal trip at a time of like really great pressure and a lot of information and a really important time. You know, whether we didn't know that or not, I'm not sure if I would look back at it differently, but at least we had that information at hand and we could judge the actions he's taking, because as we found out over the next 2 years, the actions of the governor during the pandemic were really important what he's choosing day to day. So I think, you know, just take it collectively of, you know, transparency and just having the facts at hand as a public to be able to judge decisions that a governor is making.
Yeah. And, you know, in this most recent case, we, the public, only knew because both the governor and the lieutenant governor were out of state. So the responsibility shifted to Secretary of State Bill Galvin, who announced it. If that hadn't happened, we wouldn't have known.
The governor noted that she does release her calendar, which is more than we've gotten from past governors of releasing that. So eventually we would have had a sense that she was out of state. I guess in that real time, yes, that we would not have known at the time, you know, unless, you know, Secretary of State Bill Galvin's office, you know, took the steps of like, hey, I'm acting governor. I'm running the shift, guys, for the next couple of days. There is that. There's like sort of these things that since she's taken office, I think the Governor Healey kind of set a baseline of promising to be, you know, more transparent in ways than other governors have. And she has taken steps like releasing her calendar and other things. But I think there's also, you know, this sort of pullback to a degree on transparency that we've seen from predecessors where it's, you know, it's sort of like a mixed bag, if you will, of how she's approached this, where some things we're getting more, some we're getting less. And again, it's take it all together because, you know, I think the public wants to judge what their leaders are doing, what the choices they're making. So transparency provides the best avenue to be able to do that.
Yeah. Yawu, as a longtime analyst and observer of the political scene, do you feel like you have gotten a satisfying answer here?
No, but I mean, I think with regard to where the governor's going, I mean, I think there's a concern that you know, in the past with some political leaders, you know, they're taking vacations with industry leaders or, you know, even lobbyists, and you need to know that. But on the flip side, you know, this is the first elected woman governor, the first openly you know, gay governor, and she probably faces a degree of harassment that we see this with a lot of women in political positions that males who are in those positions don't face. So I can understand a desire to keep the family safe.
Mm. I want to talk a bit about the emergency shelter system. There's a big vote coming up in the state Senate on Thursday. Chris, we heard the governor reiterate that she is supportive of limits broadly. You know, there are two sort of different ideas in the House and Senate. Can you kind of break down the two different packages and what we might see come out that she might actually be able to sign?
Yeah, the Senate on Monday put forward their own version of a supplemental budget that would cap shelter stays at 9 months. And give some folks an opportunity to extend that stay for 90-day increments. The House also suggested in a similar fashion a 9-month time limit and 3-month extensions for a certain group of people. I thought where the bills most diverged was how they fund the shelter system for the remainder of fiscal year 24 and fiscal year 25. The Senate looks to tap a majority of a transitional escrow account. These are dollars that are left over from the pandemic that the Senate would like to shuttle towards, you know, immediate needs this fiscal year and those into fiscal year 25. The House taking a more pared down approach. I believe it's in the $245 million range for needs only this fiscal year.
So a shorter term plan than the Senate's.
Sure. Yeah. The House plan doesn't really address FY25. I think House lawmakers pointed to the fact that they're in the middle of their FY25 budget process, and maybe we'll see something in that. But certainly, you know, at some point, FY25 needs to be addressed.
And we're sort of on a ticking clock here because state officials have estimated that this whole system is going to run out of money in the spring. Here we are in the spring. Do you have any clarity of when this money needs to be passed to keep these, you know, this massively overburdened system running?
You know, I don't have a specific date off the top of my head, but you're absolutely right. It is the spring, and this sup with the money that's in it is really time sensitive. And you know, I'll just be watching, since we have some differentiation between the House and the Senate. You know, how quickly can the two branches get a compromise deal put before the governor, and then, you know, will the governor accept what the House and Senate have been put before her?
Matt, what are you watching for in this debate? And we're entering sort of the busy season with the budget and with the legislative session ending in July. What are kind of the big themes and storylines you're watching in the next few months?
Well, I think it definitely wraps in with sort of how they deal with shelters, because it's just, where do you get the money to do everything that you need and mm-hmm. want to do? And the shelter system is an interesting example because, yeah, there's like this pot of money sitting aside of just extra money that, you know, the officials have wanted to use for, you know, something big, transformative, you know, big swings. And now there's, you know, at least the Senate and the governor want to sort of fill the hole of what they need to spend on the shelter. And that money's not going to last forever. Yeah. And it becomes a question of when does this really start putting really pressure on your budget, where you have revenues going down at the same time, and you have you know, countless other things that you want to fund through that. So I think it's really kind of coming to a head, and sort of the decisions they make of what pots of money do they use and how long will they last is like, is going to have ripple effects on, like, you know, name the issue and how do you fund it, how do you pay for it, because that really the next couple of months are going to be like really key of what decisions they make going forward for the next year and going and even past that of how they kind of make this all work.
Yeah. Yawa, one of the big tensions I kept thinking about during that interview is that she's laying out these really ambitious plans, the housing bond bill, economic development. You know, she is a Democratic governor who wants to build and do things, but she's facing this tightening fiscal climate and real questions about where the money's going to come from. You know, something that our past Republican governor Charlie Baker didn't really have to. We were sort of flush with money and pandemic relief funds. How do you see her finding that balance, and what is the path forward for her here?
Yeah, and these cycles are predictable in that we know that there's always going to be a contraction or recession, or, you know, that revenue is going to decline. And the governor came in on a promise of, you know, hefty tax cuts and delivered on that, you know, pretty early on. And, you know, just interesting that we're dealing with the consequences so quickly after that. It's going to be a major challenge for the governor and for the legislature. Human services are usually in the governor's 9C cuts. That's what, you know, the area where the most pain was felt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we might just be at the beginning of that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Yawa Miller, formerly of the Bay State Banner, Matt Stout, politics reporter for the Boston Globe, and Chris Van Buskirk, State House reporter for the Boston Herald. Thank you all for joining us.